So my talk is not actually about new quantum algorithms, but old quantum algorithms, algorithms that are fairly old now, but about some problems in cryptography that old quantum algorithms seem to have an interesting relationship with, and just exploring that relationship. And some of this is joint work with Mark Adcock. So as many of you know, the development of the theory of quantum algorithms started off in this somewhat abstract model, this black box model, where instead of really having the data in front of you, what you had is some kind of an oracle or black box that you could perform queries to. You could ask questions and get the answer to your question, the value of a function at some point. And you couldn't get any other information. You couldn't get information about the function in any other way. And the goal was, it's like a game, to determine some property of f, asking a minimum number of questions. So sort of like a 20 questions game. And the questions can be phrased so that they're in reversible form, so that the transformation is reversible by outputting the input again and just XORing the answer onto another bit. And then in this framework, it seemed to be useful to explore the kinds of games that can be played using quantum information and how they can exceed what you can do with classical information. So sort of the history of quantum algorithms, well, there are some steps missing here, but the first result really was by David Deutsch, who showed that there's a problem which, in the quantum case, you can solve by just asking one question in an appropriate superposition of inputs, which in the classical case would require two questions. And a few years later, Deutsch and Josa improved this to an exponential separation, 1 versus 2 to the n. But this 2 to the n number of questions that would have to be asked, it was only that amount if you insisted that you're never allowed to make any mistakes. So a perfect classical algorithm would require that amount. But if you allowed classical algorithms to be probabilistic and make error with some small probability, then actually the separation isn't so impressive anymore, because then it can be solved with a small or constant number of queries. And then Bernstein and Bazzarani showed a separation 1 versus n, which was less dramatic, but where the classical lower bound of the number of questions is more robust. It's n, even if you're allowed to err with some small probability. And then by recursively applying this algorithm, they got a separation from polynomial. So this, by taking this problem and recursively applying it, there was another problem which in the quantum case can be solved with a polynomial number of questions, but where in the classical case you need more than a polynomial number. It's sub-exponential but super polynomial. And this is somewhat complicated, but it was the first algorithm or case where the polynomial versus super polynomial bound was broken. But shortly afterwards, Simon came up with a simpler separation that actually yields exponential cost in the classical case and only linear cost in the quantum case. And very shortly afterwards, Shor, looking at Simon's paper, realized that Simon was doing some kind of period finding, and Shor looked at another version of period finding for which the separation is constant versus exponential. And period finding is a very useful thing to solve a lot of problems such as factoring integers, if you can find the periods of functions efficiently. So the quantum algorithm that I want to focus on is the first one in this list due to Bernstein and Bazzarani. And you can look at these as sort of stepping stones towards the factoring algorithm. And maybe until the factoring algorithm was discovered, one could look at this this initial work and wonder whether this is really leading anywhere, because this is all in this somewhat abstract black box model. And well, it did lead somewhere. Interesting. And again, what is the role of this Bernstein-Bazzarani problem? Maybe it wasn't the biggest stepping stone, or maybe it was, depending on how you look at it. But nevertheless, that problem has some nice structural features. which are of note. So let's just quickly go over the problem that that algorithm was solving. There, the function was computing an inner product with an unknown string. So A is some n-bit string that's somehow embedded in the function, and the goal is to figure out that string A. And when you perform a query on a particular n-bit string x, what you get is this inner product modulo 2. So these are sort of the products of the bits of A and the bits of x, and then you add them mod 2. This plus with a circle is the exclusive OR or sum mod 2. And classically, you see this, it's very easy to analyze this in the classical case. Because when you perform a query, you only get one bit of information because only one bit changes. You don't get any information from these first n bits. And the total amount of information you're trying to acquire is n bits. If A was chosen randomly, say. And therefore, just by information theory, you have to make at least n queries. And if you query for these particular inputs, like for this input here, if you take the inner product of this with A, you get the first bit of A, and with this you get the second bit. So these would be the n queries that you would make. Okay, so now in the quantum mechanical case, the algorithm is really simple. And the algorithm is sort of a realization that this black box is giving you actually the answer. It's just that in the classical world, it's giving the answer in a coordinate system that you can't access in the classical world. But if you change the basis in which this query is performed, which you're allowed to do, in a sense, with quantum information, then in fact, just by performing one query, out pop the n bits of A. So information comes out here, and no information comes out here. So it's a kind of a curious thing, and it's sort of this type of phenomenon happens in other, almost every quantum algorithm. You can sort of see something like this happening, where information, and if you look in a certain basis, then information is coming out where you wouldn't expect it to come out, maybe. Okay. Okay, so that's this Bernstein and Vazzareni algorithm. And notice the date. I meant to stress that was 1993. Okay, now I'd like to look at this problem that Goldreich and Levin looked at in 1989. And first, let's define it. And in this problem, you're performing inner product queries, which I'll call IP. But now there's sort of a noise in the situation. And what happens is that for some x's, you get the inner product, and for other x's, you get the negation of the inner product. And so there's some set of all the inputs, all the n-bit strings, which we'll call the good x's. And the only condition we have is that the good x's are slightly more than half of all possible x's. And the goal is, again, to find A. Now, if exactly half the x's were good and half were bad, then it's possible to argue that you actually get no information about what A is by making a query, because essentially what you get is just a random bit, if you look at it the right way. So the only thing that's giving you any information about A is this epsilon, this amount by which the fraction of good x's is better than a half. And a comment is, notice the date, 1989. So what were they doing with this problem? They weren't working on quantum computing, I can tell you that, because probably like me, they, as a good computer scientist, they hadn't heard about quantum computers. Maybe Gilles Brassard had, and a few others. And they were actually looking at it in a totally different context. But it was still useful. In fact, this is a very important result, which in another context about which I'll tell you later. But from our point of view, it's just a noisy version of Bernstein and Vazzarani's problem. And let's explore how this problem was solved. And this is in the classical case. And first, let's look at the case where the fraction of good x's was sizable. It's more than a quarter. So that means that the epsilon, if the epsilon is more than a quarter, then the fraction of good x's is more than 3/4. Because it turns out that version of the problem is much easier to solve. And in order to solve it, you could try to compute the inner product of A and x for various choices of x. But if you choose the wrong x, then you'll get the wrong answer. And every time you query with that x, you'll continually get the wrong answer, and you'll never know it. So there's no point in just choosing any polynomial set of x's and performing queries, because they might happen to be in the bad set. But what you can do is, well, since the linear product is linear, if you, for a dot x is equal to a dot x plus r plus a dot r for any r. And the idea is you can choose r at random. And then what you're doing is you're taking a fixed x and you're converting a query into two queries in where the thing that you, the input is a random, a dot r, which is random, and a dot x plus r, which is also random. And if you use the inner product black box, in each case you'll get an error probability of 1/4 minus delta, and therefore the probability that one of these two queries gives you the wrong answer is the sum of these, which is 1/2 minus 2 delta. So you're still getting an advantage greater than a half of getting the right answer for this x. And now this probability is not with respect to x. And that's useful, because then you can pick another r and you get an independent sample of something that's correlated with this probability. And you can choose just repeatedly do this for many r's, and you can amplify. You don't need to actually pick that many. It amplifies very quickly. And then you get, with high probability, you get a dot x. So this is straightforward. Notice it. Basically, this fails quite miserably if the epsilon is less than 1/4, less than or equal to 1/4, because then when you add these two error probabilities, you're adding things that might be bigger than 1/4 each, and the total error might hit the 1/2 way mark of 50%, and then you could get no information. You just get a random coin flip. So let's look at the low advantage case for this problem now. And, well, the first issue that comes up is that there isn't even a unique solution for A in the low advantage case. And that's because, well, you can argue it by thinking of this inner product as a Hadamard code. If these are all the possible values of A, so these are n-bit strings, then these are all the inner products. So for each choice of A, like for 0, 1, 1, these are all the values that a correct inner product black box would return when you perform the queries. And these are the code words of a Hadamard code. And the distance between code words is 1/2 the length of all the code words. Between each of these two strings, half of the bits agree and half disagree. And, well, there's a result in coding theory that if you want to be able to so you have a noisy code word, basically that oracle, and that you can look at that code word in various places. And in order for there to be a unique deciphering of that code word, the number of errors has to be less than half the distance. And if the distance is 1/2, well, the number of errors should be less than 1/4, which was the high advantage case, but we're not in that case anymore. So we have multiple solutions. And in sort of traditional coding theory, there's a way of dealing with this situation, which is to just not get into that position to begin with, to use a different code, possibly with a lower capacity or a lower rate, or maybe concatenate this code with another code. But this is sort of the pathological case where there really isn't possible to perform the decoding. But actually, the number of solutions to this decoding problem, although it's not unique, it's not really that high. It goes about like order 1 over epsilon squared. So that's polynomial in 1 over epsilon. And if epsilon is 1/8, for instance, there are only a constant number of solutions. So it doesn't sound that unreasonable to just ask to find all solutions. At least it's a well-defined problem. And in fact, this kind of coding problem, it's called list decoding. And it's been list decoding has been developed by computer scientists in the last 10 or so years. And it's turned out to have a lot of useful connections with in complexity theory. And maybe this is essentially one of them, this Goldreich-Levin theorem. So another way formally we could deal with the issue about uniqueness of solutions is to have a second black box that checks the right answer. So this would be what we could call an equivalence query, where you input x and it reports 1 if x equals a and 0 otherwise. And then you can perform these noisy inner product queries. So working with these two queries together, it makes sense to find a. What the inner product queries do is they sort of narrow down your search space, which is initially exponentially large, to a polynomial number, and then using this equivalence query, we can sort of check everything in that smaller list in a reasonable number of queries and narrow it down to 1a. But if you had just one of the two queries alone, you wouldn't be able to solve the problem, at least not efficiently. So how was this problem solved? First on stating the results, the number of queries is polynomial in n over epsilon. And the initial solution of Goldreich and Levin was it was worse than this. And then with some refinements to Rakoff and then Goldreich later on, it was shown that these are actually the best numbers known, that n over epsilon squared inner product queries, 1 over epsilon squared equivalence queries. That's just because that's the number of potential solutions to check. And then if you count all the additional gates, ANDORs and NOT gates, it would be that amount. And let me sketch the idea, because it's quite an interesting algorithm that uses some clever tricks. So we go back to this idea that if you want to compute a dot x for a particular x, you could choose a random r and compute a dot x plus r and a dot r. But if you tried to use the black box to do both of them, well, then you'd have two errors, and they could sum up to more than a half, because the error probabilities aren't small enough. So why don't we just try something really simple? That sounds too simple to be of any use, which is to just basically try both possibilities here. This is some bit b, and then we could try both b equals 0 and b equals 1, and we know one of those is going to work. Well, that's no good, and the problem is that you're not just doing this once. To amplify, you need to do this several times, and there are several b's, and if you use the same b each time, well, it might not be right, so you really would have to try 2 to the m possibilities. But in fact, you don't. And the idea is that you can generate several of these random r's so that they're not completely independent of each other. They're just pairwise independent. And the corresponding b's, using a small number of seeds, using only a logarithmic number of seed bits. And that's actually based on the Hadamard code, but using it in a different scale. And therefore, having the pairwise independent r's to perform the amplification is sufficient. And in that case, there won't really be that many b's to try. In fact, there'll only be a logarithmic number of bits on which all the b's depend on. And then because there are a logarithmic number of bits, we can afford to try all possibilities. And this gives us n squared over epsilon squared, but with an additional trick put on top of it, you can pull out a factor of n. And that other trick, it's interesting because coding theory comes up a lot here. Classical coding theory uses another kind of error correcting code to get rid of that factor of n. So we have n over epsilon squared to solve this problem. And that's this Goldreich-Levin solution to this noisy inner product problem. And now I'd like to look at the quantum algorithm for this noisy Bernstein-Vazirani problem or Goldreich-Levin problem. And the quantum, how am I doing with time? I think I have enough time to show it to you, because there it is. And sort of the kicker here is that the same algorithm, we don't have to deal with all these complications that came up in the classical case. Just use the same quantum algorithm in the original case for the noiseness case. And what you get, instead of getting the bits of A, what you would get if you perform these operations is you'd get some quantum state whose overlap with A or fidelity is at least 2 epsilon. And therefore, if you just measured it in the computational basis with probability 4 over epsilon squared, you get the answer. So repeating this 1 over epsilon squared times, you get the right answer with high probability. So we got rid of the factor of n in the quantum case. And in fact, you can reduce the epsilon in the denominator from epsilon squared to just epsilon by using amplification rather than just doing several repetitions. If you combine these inner product queries with the equivalence queries, I mean, it just fits like a glove into the amplitude amplification framework. So essentially, you're using Grover's algorithm to speed up the search by a square root factor and or a square root amount. And therefore, you would get 1 over epsilon inner product queries, 1 over epsilon equivalence queries, and then n over epsilon other gates. And why does this work? Why don't we run into these complications? Well, I'm not sure that I really completely know the answer to that question, but one part of an answer is that, well, since you're only making one query to begin with, you don't have to worry about this problem that these error probabilities add up when you make multiple queries and make things worse. So that problem that existed in the classical case, it just doesn't come up to begin with, so you, since you don't have to worry about it. Now, what about the, is it possible to do better in the classical case? I said n over epsilon squared, but in fact that can be shown to be optimal with a few conditions. And well, here's a theorem that in the classical Goldreich-Levin problem, you need to make a constant over epsilon squared inner product queries or a large number of equivalence queries to solve it. And the idea of this proof, well, it's again, it's an information theoretic argument. If you sort of view noise in the right way, each inner product query is like giving you the exact inner product, but through a noisy channel. And if you analyze the amount of information going through the channel, it's just proportional to epsilon squared. And in order to reduce the number of equivalence queries to something this amount or less, 2 to the n over 2 or less, you'd have to make n over 2 divided by the amount of information per query. So there you get the lower bound. There are a few technical issues, but that's essentially what makes it work. So to summarize the analysis of this Goldreich-Levin problem, we have a separation, n over epsilon squared classical versus 1 over epsilon quantum. Now, what about the question of why Goldreich and Levin were interested in this to begin with? That's what I'd like to tell you about now. And they were interested in studying properties of one-way functions. And let's just consider invertible one-way functions here, so one-way permutations. And this is in complexity theory-based cryptography. These are very useful tools. A one-way function is a function that, given x, if we call the function pi, it's easy to go from x to pi of x, let's say in polynomial time. But it's hard to go the other way. Given pi of x, it's hard to figure out x. And we have to take a little bit of care in defining what we mean by the hardness condition. But we could say if x is chosen at random, then and we compute in polynomial time, then the probability is very small that we'll be able to get x if we were given pi of x. Of course, we could search through all possibilities. So the information is there. It just might not be possible to find it in a reasonable amount of time. So an example, a simple example would be this exponentiation function modulo a prime. So let p be a large prime. And then consider this multiplicative group of the numbers between 1 and less than p. And this group has generators. So a generator would be a number such that all powers of the generator yield the same set. It's the original thing. And then the exponentiation function is a function that maps x to d times x modulo p. And this exponentiation is easy to do by repeated squaring classically in essentially n squared time. But going the other way, this is a discrete logarithm problem for which no polynomial time algorithm is known for most values of p. Of course, quantum computers could break that function. Now, that's a one-way function. There's let me mention another issue, that if you have a one-way function, it means that given pi of x, it's hard to figure out all the bits of x, but it doesn't mean that it's hard to figure out any particular bit of x. It might be easy to find the first three bits of x, and it could still be one-way. So there's another object called a hard bit of a one-way function, which has the property that it's hard to compute given the function. So a hard bit, if you have a one-way function pi going from n-bit strings to n-bit strings, so it's a function that's hard to invert, then a hard bit is a function that takes an n-bit string and just gives you one bit that has the property that if you're given x, it's easy to compute that bit, but if you're given pi of x, then it's hard to compute that bit. Not only is it hard to compute it exactly, but it's hard to really do better than just guess, than just compute it with 50% probability. It's hard to guess with some perhaps polynomial advantage over just random guessing. So assuming this exponentiation function that I just mentioned previously is one way, and well, it's not known to be one way even classically. But if it were, then it can be shown that the high order bit of x for some values of p is hard. So somehow all the hardness associated with inverting that function is sort of embodied in the problem of just figuring out the high order bit of x. And these high order bit, these hard bits are useful objects in cryptography. I'll give you an application in a moment. But let's just note that it's not necessarily the case that you can just choose one of the bits of x. And there may be one-way functions where no individual bit of x is actually hard. Because it's conceivable that each individual bit of x, there's a way of guessing it with probability 3/4. But of course, that doesn't mean that you're going to have a very high probability of succeeding with all the bits of x, because that would be only succeed with probability 3/4 to the n. So you might not be able to just take an individual bit. It might seem like a prudent thing to just take the parity of all the bits of x, because if there's a little bit of hardness in every bit, then maybe this somehow brings it all together. But in fact, one can come up with one-way functions that have the property that figuring out the parity of all the bits of x is also easy. So it's not trivial to come up with one-way functions. With hard bits given one-way functions. And a question is there some sort of generic H that is in some sense a hard bit for any one-way function? So where we don't really have to worry about whether the one-way function is based on modular exponentiation, like the discrete log problem, or whether it's based on something totally different, different kind of complexity theoretic context. But if you're just given any one-way function, is there a way to get a hard bit out of it? So that's the question. And I won't answer that right away. First, I'll mention just an application quickly of hard bits. You could use hard bits for bit commitment, because bit commitment is a very useful primitive in cryptography. And the idea there is, the hard bit can be used as a pad you could basically do, Alice could choose a random x, compute pi of x, send pi of x, the value y, to Bob, and now Alice has fixed the value of x in Bob's mind, but she hasn't actually told him what x is, and then she can XOR the hard bit with the bit she's committing to, and send that XOR. And now from Bob's point of view, figuring out what the hard bit is, figuring out what b is tantamount to computing the hard bit, and if it's a hard bit, Bob can't do that. But at a later stage, Alice could decommit by sending x, and then Bob could just verify that x really is the pi inverse of y. And if it is, then Bob could compute the hard bit. Because given x, you can compute the hard bit, but given pi of x, you can't. And Alice can't change her mind, because there's only one x that will somehow satisfy Bob as a valid decommittal. And this is perfectly binding and computationally concealing, which means that the bindingness condition, meaning that Alice can't change her mind, is sort of information theoretically guaranteed, regardless of how much computing power Alice has. She can't change her mind because there's only one inverse to only one value of pi inverse of y. But it's only concealing in the computational sense, because if Bob had unlimited computing power, he could break the one-way function and then figure out the hard bit. And if you wanted things to be completely information theoretic, well, that's impossible using classical information as well as using quantum information. So here's Goldreich and Levin's hard bit construction. you start with a one-way function, and from n bits to n bits, and you first of all, you change it, you sort of massage it to another function that takes two n bits to two n bits. And the way you do it is the first n bits, you apply the one-way function, and the second n bits, you do nothing to. So this doesn't look that exciting. It's still a one-way function, because to invert it, you have to invert the first half of the bits, but you don't really have to do much work to invert the second half. But now that we've defined this modified one-way function, we can define a hard predicate for it, which is the inner product of the two input strings. And the claim is that this is a hard bit. Okay. So that's their construction. And the proof that it's hard is based on the based on this Goldreich-Levin algorithm. Assume that there's some algorithm that's able to predict y dot x if you're given pi of y and x with some advantage. So you choose y and x randomly, you apply the one-way function pi to y, and you feed that function value as well as x to this algorithm g, and then g is somehow trying to figure out what this hard bit is, this inner product. And we can define different kinds of advantages. Epsilon advantage would mean that the chances of g succeeding are better than a half by epsilon for random x and y. There's another more complicated definition of an advantage, and that turns out to be useful for our purposes, and the two advantages are related to each other, so it's not really such a big... this is the definition I want to use, or that is used, and it's, if you have this kind of advantage, you can convert it into this kind. And in that case, you're sort of splitting the role of x and y. For a fixed value of y, we can call it epsilon good. If for that fixed value of y, if you choose x randomly, you get an advantage epsilon. But for some y's, you might not get this property. So epsilon delta advantage means that you get that property for y with probability at least delta. So with probability at least delta, you get a good y. And for that good y, it means that if you fix that y and choose x randomly, you'll get some advantage. And there's a theorem that if you have epsilon advantage, you can get epsilon over 2. You get the other kind of advantage with a slight dilution in the parameters. So let's assume that it did happen that y was epsilon good. So now we fix y. And then consider this this function that has sort of y hardwired into it. But we actually, the function doesn't know the value of y. It just has pi of y hardwired into it. Perhaps this diagram is a bit misleading in that respect. And g takes a value of x and produces f of x such that f of x is either y dot x or the negation of that with advantage 1 half plus epsilon, advantage epsilon. Okay, now that should start to look like the Goldreich-Levin oracle. It's sort of computing the inner product with some noise. And therefore, if you queried x n over epsilon squared times, then you could figure out what y is, which would allow you to invert the function. And that means that the time, whatever time it takes to run this algorithm g that breaks the hard bit, this quantity would bound the time it takes to invert pi. So therefore, just moving things around, if you start with a bound of how hard it is to invert pi, then you get a bound for how hard it is to invert the one-way, the hard bit, excuse me. G is breaking the hard bit. And you don't get quite as good a bound because there's this dilution factor, which is the overhead in the reduction. So you multiply by epsilon squared and divide by n. Okay, now if the time is super polynomial, if the original one-way function took more than a polynomial amount of time to invert, and if epsilon, if the advantage that we're interested in is something that's 1 over a polynomial, then the time to achieve that advantage would be also super polynomial. But for other parameterizations, you don't get a good bound because you're sort of blown away by this dilution factor. It takes away anything that you've gained. What happens in the quantum world? In the quantum world, well, performing bit commitment information based on information theory alone, well, that's now well known to be impossible. But it still makes sense to define a quantum one-way function. That's even for a quantum computer, it can be computed in the forward direction, but it can't be computed in the reverse direction. And now this exponential function isn't one. That was, I think, Shor's before factoring. He showed how to break this discrete log problem, which is tantamount to inverting this function. But nevertheless, people have looked at what you can do with quantum one-way functions. And Dumais, Myers, and Savai showed that you can get some kind of bit commitment based on the quantum one-way function. It's perfectly concealing and computationally binding. And what we get is, if you use this Goldreich-Levin theorem, you also get you get a hard. You can use the Goldreich-Levin theorem to get a quantum hard bit. And I'm getting a bit ahead. But then with the quantum hard bit, you can then perform bit commitment also. And because it's a more efficient algorithm in the quantum case, you get a smaller dilution factor. It's only epsilon that you multiply by. So for this parameterization, the sort of toy set of values, if the time to invert pi were n cubed, and we wanted to get advantage 1 over n, then the reduction would imply that it would take at least time n squared to do that. Whereas in the classical case, you just get a constant. And you can also use this quantum one-way function to do quantum bit commitment and quantum qubit commitment. The quantum qubit commitment is easy. You just basically, it's written here, but maybe I won't go into it because I think I'm running out of time. But you get the different kind of security because then Dumais, Myers, and Savai, they got perfectly concealing computationally binding. We get computationally concealing and perfectly binding. And a recent result by Crépeau, Nagare, and Savai shows that you can actually switch from computationally concealing perfectly binding to the other kind. So we get both kinds. And there are some open problems here, which I'll just end with. One is to find good candidates for quantum one-way functions. There are some problems that have resisted fast solution by quantum algorithms, some classical problems. And you also have an advantage for quantum one-way functions is that computing the function in the forward direction, you have more options available to you because there may be functions that classically you can't compute efficiently in the forward direction. There are other hard bit constructions. This is perhaps just the simplest one that I gave, but there are other ones that are in some sense better. And how would the quantum reductions work in that case? Maybe you can get other speedups. And more generally, in cryptography, the reductions are all over the place and in many settings. And it's just, I think, an interesting area to look for places where you get something different using quantum reductions instead of classical reductions. And maybe in some cases you can get something where you get a difference between polynomial and exponential using a quantum reduction. In this case, the improvement was only polynomial. So thank you for your attention.
Time for a few questions.
Daniel? It's interesting. I mean, you couldn't do bit commitment using that one-wayness, but you can do other things. Perhaps is that something that's employed in your signature?
Yeah,
schemes.
Okay. Consideration that
Okay.